Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Nancy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm your host today, Al Warren. The rest of the crew is on their holiday this week. So now we're going to venture into the mystery of religion. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the Quran and the Bible. And joining us, we've got the professor of Islamic studies and theology, Gabriel Sayed Reynolds. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be with you, Al.
So let's first talk about you. What drew you into Islamic studies and to where you become a professor? And you've gone a long way with this. What was there a calling for you, or did it just sort of one thing led to another?
My journey in Islamic studies began really when I was an undergraduate, and I started traveling to the Middle East. You notice I have that interesting middle name, which is, you know, Saeed, and that comes from Arab roots that I have in my family. So I began traveling to Jordan and Syria, and the real goal was to find my distant relatives who were over there. But, you know, from the very first moment that I traveled to the Islamic world, I was fascinated by Islam as a religion, by the intensity of faith that Muslims have. I still remember when I first got out of the plane into the airport in Amman, Jordan, in 1994, and they had the call to prayer, which some people might recognize, but they had it broadcasting inside the airport itself. And it made me think, wow, these people take their religion seriously. And I was fascinated by Islam. And, you know, for the past several decades, I continued to study it.
Now, you've got a new book out, The Quran and the Bible.
Right.
What was the purpose behind this book? Like, what is it that you want people to understand after, you know, from reading the book?
Mm-hmm. Right, so the book is basically an effort to show that the Quran and the Bible can be read together, that these two books belong together and not apart. And, of course, we think of the history of religions, and we think of a lot of conflict between religions, maybe between Islam and Christianity and Judaism in particular. Of course, a lot of that is true. There's been a lot of conflict, even violence through the centuries. But when we look at the scriptures and the beliefs in these two religions, we see that there's a lot of similarities. And, you know, even more directly, a lot of people coming from non-Muslim backgrounds have tried to read the Quran, and sometimes they find it a challenging book to read in order to understand its references. Well, what this book does is it shows how the Quran in many of its passages is connected to the Bible, and it's not as strange or foreign or unfamiliar as many people might think. So it draws a lot of those connections, traces stories which are in common between the Quran and the Bible, and also speaks about how the Quran sort of developed not in a different or foreign environment, but from the heart of the Jewish and Christian traditions.
So now these three are Abrahamic faiths, Islam,
right,
Hebrew, and the New Testament, you know, Christian. Why is there such a distance between them?
Right.
I mean, that's a lot of picture.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's an important question, though. I'm glad you raised it. I think a lot of the conflict has to do with the interpretation of the scriptures and the way in which religious leaders through the centuries have developed their own beliefs in opposition to the other religions. But when we look at the Quran and the Bible in particular, we see that many of the characters, for example, are in common. So Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Mary are all found in the Quran. Many of the stories about these figures are common as well. So just to begin with the beginning, the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, which is, of course, in the book of Genesis, is also found in the Quran. In fact, it's told many times in the Quran. And so I think when we return to the scriptures and we study them carefully, we can build bridges and see connections between the different faiths. But sometimes it's in the domain of interpretation and the later building up of religious systems and doctrine or dogma that people are divided.
Right. You know, I think a lot of the mainstream, a lot of the public that do not know the religion very well, from what I hear, a lot of people think that the Prophet Muhammad was actually the guy that wrote the Quran. And I hear that a lot. And in reality, he didn't.
Yes, that's a very challenging question. That's sort of the big question for scholars, you know, understanding the authorship of the Quran. But you make a very good point. For Muslims, and that's really important to emphasize, for Muslims, the author of the Quran is God. You know, the traditional picture of the revelation of the Quran is that God revealed the Quran in some sort of mysterious, which is good for your show, mysterious metaphysical way to the angel Gabriel. And then the angel Gabriel brought the Quran down from heaven to earth and spoke the words of God, which he had received to Muhammad. So Muhammad is like the spokesperson or the mouthpiece for divine revelation. Sometimes tell my students, you know, the Islamic view of the revelation of the Quran is a bit like, imagine a statue in a fountain through which water is flowing. You know, Muhammad is just that statue, the water coming as pure when it leaves as when it enters. So, I mean, that's from the Islamic point of view. God is the author of the Quran. When Muslims, you know, quote a verse in the Quran, they say, "And God said." They don't say, "And Muhammad said." Now, when it comes to critical scholarship, of course, scholars in the West debate, you know, usually in the academy, people wouldn't say simply "God said" because they would take a distant or outsider's perspective. And then they'll have lots of debates. Is it, in fact, Muhammad? Is it more than one author? Some of it quoted from the Bible, and the book enters into some of those questions.
But Muhammad himself didn't want the Quran or any of his teachings written while he was alive. This it was done by other people after his death, right?
Right. The traditional account is that Muhammad, he would recite the Quran, and it would be memorized by his followers. But he was never sure if God might reveal a verse that would replace or abrogate an earlier verse. So there's this tradition that God sometimes would reveal something, and then because circumstances changed, he would reveal something to replace that earlier revelation. So Muhammad's policy basically was, listen, we're not going to write anything down because something could be replaced. We don't want confusion here. And so during his lifetime, according to the traditional story, he never had the Quran recorded, and he didn't write it himself. And it was only after his life, and there are a couple of stories that Muslims tell about this, that, you know, I enter a little bit into the book, the Quran and the Bible, that a number of Muslims who had memorized the Quran died in battles. And some of the early followers of Muhammad became anxious that with their death, the Quran itself would be lost. Not only would these fighters be lost, but the Quran would be lost that existed only in their hearts or their minds. And so they came to the decision to go to the leader of the Islamic community, known as the Caliph, and demand that the Quran be written down.
Wow. So how, with that being said, how is it that we can rely on the different people that have assembled the Quran?
That's a very critical point. And for sort of the development or the articulation of Muslim apologetics, you know, the defense of the faith, that's almost as important as arguing for the initial revelation of the Quran from God, right? Because the text that Muslims hold in their hands today is the product of that process that took place, exactly as you said, after the death of the Prophet. And so there's a general consensus that the early Muslim believers who assembled the Quran, and especially the first four caliphs, who were known as the rightly guided caliphs, those first four rulers after Muhammad, that they were very careful in the work they did, and that we can rely that the Quran that is in our hands today, that was passed down to us, is essentially identical to the Quran that Muhammad proclaimed to his followers, orally.
So you were talking about this, I don't know how to put it in a word, but you were talking about how strongly people felt about their religion in the Arabic
right.
communities, and like, you know, the prayers
right.
and the Quran is only recited in Arabic, and, you know, there's different things, and
right.
how it's in the airport and stuff. Why is it that the Quran in Islam is so strict, I guess, at their religion as compared to, let's say, Christian or Catholics and Jews even?
Right, yeah, that's a very important point. I mean, I think it's true that there's a certain, we could say, universality to Islamic beliefs. You know, there's a saying that Muslims have, which is, Islam is religion and state. The Arabic is deen wa dawla. And, you know, not all Muslims would actually agree with that, but many would. Many would say, yeah, that's, you know, that's accurate, that Islam isn't just about faith, it's not just about spirituality, it's not just about prayer, but it's a complete system of life. This isn't absolutely clear from the Quran itself, because the Quran actually doesn't have very many rules and laws. But the way that Islam develops in the first centuries, there's a whole body of literature which develops basically principles for life. And that's for the individual and how he or she conducts his or her daily life, but also for society and questions like economics, politics, ethics. And so you get this code which becomes known, and you know, your audience will probably have heard the term Sharia, becomes known as the Sharia, which is this code or this law, which is very global, which covers things as specific as what you can eat or what you can wear, and things like policy on war and peace. And so in some ways, the religion of Islam is articulated through that law. And that's the essence for many Muslims of the religion, is law. Not for all Muslims. It's important not to, you know, overemphasize or exaggerate that point, because Islam is diverse, after all.
Now, can I ask, the Quran itself and Islam, do they have variations within their own religion, such as Christianity has quite a few different,
sure.
you know, perceptions and beliefs?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So there certainly are, and some of it is not seen. So there's the one big division that many people, you know, in the West will be familiar with, which is between Sunnis and Shiites. We could speak about that. But in fact, the way Islam is organized is that there's not there aren't church bodies, there aren't denominations. And so within Sunnism and within Shiism, there are many different currents and movements which don't have formal councils or bodies, as a Christian denomination, for example, might have, but which are very distinct. So, for example, Islam as it's practiced in Saudi Arabia, which is largely a form of Islam known as a form of Sunni Islam known as Salafism, that sort of Islam is very different from the Islam that you might find in Indonesia or in the United States. So within Sunnism, within Shiism, there are many different currents, and a lot of it has to do with how the Quran is interpreted, and the role that that the Sharia, that law, is meant to have in society.
Well, who dictates the Sharia with the two different variations? When you have Sunnis and Shiites, like how is Sharia decided, the law of God? Like in which... You know what I mean? Like who?
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, where's the authority coming from? That's a critical question for Muslims. Where is authority? You know, and most Muslims would say authority is the ultimate authority is the scripture itself. And that's why the Quran is so important. And that's why there's so much piety around the Quran. So, you know, Muslims will kiss the book before they open it and That's why, you know, I've written a book like this to try to shed light on the Quran. But in fact, what happens is a very informal process in the Islamic world, whereby Muslim leaders, by virtue of either their power or their authority or their popularity, will be able to disseminate their particular teachings. And through the popularity of their teachings, it will begin to take hold and have a greater presence in society. So individual popular Muslim leaders, for example, the Egyptian leader Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who has a very distinct position on Islamic law, will have an enormous following throughout the world, and Islam will take on the flavor or the color of the teachings of these particular leaders.
Now, some of the sayings that are used, like Allah, which is just God, Allah Akbar in that. Now, can you explain why it's used? Because a lot of people, I think, don't really understand it.
Right. Yeah, great question. So, you know, I enter a bit into this in the book. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. It appears 2,700 times in the Quran. So it's, you know, it's God is omnipresent in the Quran. It's important to note that it's simply the word for God in the Arabic language. So non-Muslim Arabs, whether they're Christians or Jews or even Baha'is or another faith, when they speak of God, they speak of Allah. So some people think that, you know, Allah is a different God or distinct God or the God of Islam. It's not exactly right, you know, because Christians and Jews are also calling God Allah. And, you know, even more, we can look at the root of that word, and it's closely related to other words in the same language family for God. So the word in Hebrew, Elohim, which means God, is related to Allah. And the word in a more obscure language, but a very important Christian language of the Middle East and the Syriac, is Allah for God, which you can hear is even closer. And so, you know, it's an ancient word that's entered in the Quran, is used for God. Incidentally, in the Quran, it's not the only word used for God, but there's a second word, which is Ar-Rahman, which means the compassionate one, which is also used simply for God. The Quran even says, listen, you don't have to call God Allah. You can also call him Ar-Rahman. Either way is fine.
Now, how strict is the Quran for people following it word for word? Because I know there's a lot of people that memorize the entire Quran. So is there something about the Quran that you're supposed to know word to word like that?
Yeah, right. That's very, very interesting because, you know, there's great piety surrounding the Quran, as I've already alluded to. It's really central to Islamic societies. And in part because of that piety, it becomes a sign of an individual's sort of religious fervor if he or she has memorized the Quran. So that's a sign of prestige, you know. In the United States, I don't know if you have a great jump shot, or where you have a beautiful singing voice. You know, that might bring you prestige. In the Islamic world, the jump shot and the singing voice, they're still important, but memorizing the Quran will bring you prestige. And, you know, parents will be very proud and oftentimes throw a celebration when their children have proven that they've memorized the entire Quran, which is quite a feat, you know. It's not a long book. It's about two-thirds the size of the New Testament. But nevertheless, that's pretty impressive to memorize the Quran. So, you know, that's a sign that of the importance of the Quran. That doesn't mean that everyone will interpret the Quran literally. And there may be certain aspects of the Quran which, you know, someone might say, well, this doesn't really apply in the 21st century. That was for the 7th century when Muhammad was living. And the other point to make is many people memorize the Quran. They may not actually understand all of it. So in many countries, let's say Indonesia, I mentioned it before, is a country where the spoken language is called Bahasa. It's not Arabic. It has no connection to Arabic. And so young Indonesian Muslims, when they learn the Quran, they're learning it in a foreign language, and they may not understand it, but they'll still memorize it because there's just prestige and piety associated with the memorization of the text.
Now, has the Quran gone through changes through time, such as the Bible? Is there different versions and I guess, updated versions, as they would call it, or different testaments of the same Bible or Quran?
Right. So, great question. the Quran, the first point to make is that Muslim scholars themselves were very interested in variants to the Quran. Now, the Islamic tradition tells us that when a definitive edition of the Quran was established during the reign of the third caliph, so this would be between the year 644 and 656, that caliph, his name was Uthman, he gathered all of the variant versions to his own. He established his own and gathered all of the variant versions to his own and had them destroyed, had them burned. And so they no longer exist. They were all destroyed by Uthman. And yet, medieval Muslim scholars say, yes, they were all destroyed, but we remember what they said because it was passed down to us in different texts and different traditions. And so they were very interested in looking at those variants and saying, oh, listen, the Quran we have, Uthman's Quran, says this, but in that other version of the Quran that Uthman destroyed, it said something else. So that's something Islamic tradition itself sort of accepted and was interested in. Now today, modern scholars are interested also in looking at and our manuscript evidence and seeing what sort of differences we can find. If there are some differences, we don't have, let's say, new chapters or even new paragraphs of the Quran, but we do have words which are different and some ordering which is different when we look at the manuscripts.
So when you were talking about the Quran and the Bible, and a lot of things that they have in common, what is one or two of the biggest things they have in common?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things in the book to highlight is that a lot of the biblical stories that your listeners will be familiar with are there in the Quran as well, but sometimes in a different format. So, for example, I mentioned Adam and Eve in the garden. We have that story repeated many times in the Quran. But, if you read Genesis carefully, you notice, who's with Adam and Eve in the garden? The word Satan or the devil does not appear. It's actually simply said that a serpent is with them. Of course, Christians later identify that serpent with Satan. And when we read the Quran, the serpent is gone and it's only Satan. Satan is in the garden. So you have those interesting connections. Similar is the story of the crucifixion of Jesus, which also appears in the Quran. Someone looks at the book, that they can look under chapter 4, verse 157 of the Quran. And there we have a reference to the crucifixion of Jesus. But, depending on how you read that verse, it could be understood as saying that it wasn't Jesus who was crucified. What happened is someone else was given the likeness or the appearance of Jesus and was crucified in his place. And Jesus escaped the crucifixion entirely and ascended into heaven, body and soul. There are some disputes over that verse, but there's one Muslim scholar who wrote a well-known book saying that the title was Crucifixion, as it's normally spelled, or Crucifixion, F-I-C-T-I-O-N. They're just a fiction that Christians invented, and in fact, Jesus was never crucified at all.
Oh. Do you say it would be a good thing for Jewish or Christians to read the Quran?
Absolutely. The Quran, even if you don't see it as the Word of God, even if you don't think the angel Gabriel brought it down from heaven to earth, it's a book which is at the heart of the religious life of hundreds of millions of Muslims throughout the world, including now many Muslims in the United States, of course, who are our neighbors here, which is essential to the articulation of politics, even of economics, but certainly of ethics and culture in the Islamic world. But, readers of the book will also discover that the Quran is part of biblical history. What happened is in the centuries after the closing of the Christian canon of the Bible, which of course includes the Hebrew Bible, Christians and Jews continued to speculate around the text and develop stories around the text. And the Quran is sort of part of that process. The Quran is sort of a new voice within those discussions about biblical stories. So it's really a part of the history of the Bible as well.
Now, with a lot of the world tensions and stuff right now, do you think that it's eventually going to come together, like the three major religions, and be as one, sort of? I know there's a differences, but, you know, more togetherness than apart.
That's a tough one. That's a big question. I mean, what we find right now in the Sunni Islamic world is that there's a real sort of tension or debate going on, even in some places a conflict, between more conservative, assertive forms of Sunni Islam associated with this movement that I referred to before called Salafism, and then Muslims striving for reform and the integration of some of the advances of the Enlightenment and modernity into Islam. So there's a struggle going on in the heart of the Islamic world right now. And, you know, we can see that playing out in, you know, some of what we're finding going on in Saudi Arabia and in Turkey and other places these days. Now, in terms of looking at the connections between the different religions, well, you know, there's some simple theological questions that are really a question of dispute. One is, you know, do we all worship the same God? You know, most Christians would say, of course we worship the same God as Jews do, because we share a scripture. You know, the Old Testament for Christians is the Bible for Jews. It's in a different order and things, but basically it's the Bible for Jews. So we must have the same God. The God of Abraham is also the God of Christians. When it comes to Islam, some Christians will hesitate, you know. The Catholic Church seems to be pretty clear in its teaching that Muslims and Christians worship the same God. But especially some strands of evangelical Protestantism would be pretty hesitant about that question. So there's a lot of dialogue that needs to go on before there's a real drawing together of the different religions.
Well, is there something specific about the Quran that makes the evangelicals not think it's the same God? I mean...
Right. Yeah, the sticking point is Jesus. It's basically about Jesus. that's really the key question, you know, because at the heart of the Christian claim is, you know, this notion of God becoming man, or the incarnation. So this is the heart of Christianity, that, you know, God, out of his love for humanity, you know, entered into human history. And the Quran is pretty clear that Islamic teaching is that Jesus is not God, is not the Son of God. He was only a prophet. There's even a verse in the Quran, you know, readers can open the book and look at chapter 5, verse 72, also verse 73 of the Quran, which has, in verse 72, it has Jesus himself reprimand his followers, saying, listen, I'm just a prophet, God is my Lord and your Lord. And so, you know, it's that question, the relationship between Jesus and God, which for a lot of evangelical thinkers, and by the way, also for a lot of Muslim thinkers, makes them hesitate to say that we actually worship the same God.
Wow. Really interesting, really interesting story and book. Now, the book is out now, and it's called The Quran and the Bible, and the author, Gabriel Saad Reynolds. Wow. Thank you very much for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Al.
Coming up next, Stephen David Lampley delivers his true crime commentary.
Forensics with Stephen David Lampley, your crime and forensics source from coast to coast.
All right, it's time for a couple of shout-outs. I want to start by giving a shout-out to Jackie Wilkes over in the United Kingdom. Shout-out to Amanda Shirley, Donna Underwood, and to Dee Sutton. Hey, if you're a listener and would like a shout-out on the radio show, just shoot me a message on my Facebook page and let me know. It's Facebook, Stephen David Lampley Page. Facebook, Stephen David Lampley Page. Just let me know and I'll give you a shout-out. All right, we're going to spend the next few minutes of the radio show discussing how to identify lies and liars. Now, this is a program that I present all across the country, and obviously in the short time we have here on this radio show, I can't possibly give you all of the information, but we're going to give you some of the information. What I will do is provide you some basic information and a beginning understanding of how the process of lie detection works without a polygraph. Let me begin, however, but let's do a little housekeeping, if you will, and explain some of the limitations of lie detection. Studies show that the average person who has no training whatsoever in lie detection can only detect lies and liars about 54% of the time. You might as well flip a coin, right? While someone who has received proper training in lie detection can typically identify lies and liars about 90% of the time. And that's a major, major difference. One of the misconceptions I encounter from a lot of people is that they think they can identify liars by using just one indicator of lying. And that is totally wrong. It's totally false. It's totally inadequate. Listen to me very carefully. One cannot latch on to 1, 2, 5, even 10 indicators and be able, with any degree of certainty, ascertain a lie. It's just not accurately possible. Now, let's take, for example, one of the most common misconceptions that I hear more than any other is that if someone won't look me in the eyes, then they're lying to me. Not true. It is just simply not true. Now, is not looking someone in their eyes an indicator of lying? Sure it is. But it's not a very reliable one. It's certainly not very reliable if that's the only thing you use. What are other reasons that someone may not look you in the eye? Okay, people with Asperger's may not be comfortable looking you in the eye when they talk to you. Someone who has PTSD may not be comfortable looking you in the eye when they talk to you. Someone who has low self-esteem or who is shy, they may not be comfortable looking you in the eyes when they talk to you. Now, what you've done is, by using that one tool, you have deemed that all of those individuals are liars because, why? They won't look you in the eye. First of all, it's not fair to them and it's feeding you a bunch of bad information. Now, on the flip side of that, we have what I call professional liars, and those are typically psychopathic personality types. They know that we're looking for them to look away when they lie to us, so they will make every effort possible to stare us down. So, you'll be looking at the professional liar because they don't look away. You're believing the professional liar and labeling all the innocent folks as liars. It's just totally inadequate. There's this old saying that goes, if the only tool you have in the toolbox is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. If the only tool you have in the toolbox is they won't look me in the eyes when they talk to me, then everybody that won't look you in the eyes is a liar. And that's not true. That's not the case. Now, the more indicators that you know and use, the more accurate you can be when you're attempting to identify lies and liars. Another misconception I hear a lot is that if someone has their arms folded across their chest, a lot of people will take that as a sign that that person is lying or being deceptive. Again, that may or may not be the case. But you have to understand, we don't walk around all day long with our arms hanging down on our sides like a bunch of zombies. Sometimes it's just simply more comfortable to fold your arms in front of you. Sometimes it's a way to keep warm. You know, again, if that's the only indicator you use, you're going to be completely misled regarding whether or not someone may be lying. Okay, Steve, so how do investigators do it? How do we know if someone is lying? We use clusters. We use clusters of indicators. After we ask a question, we observe for indicators of lying within the first 6 seconds of the answer. And we're looking for a cluster of indicators. For instance, we may observe an individual rub his neck after we ask the question, and then they may answer no in a singing fashion. For instance, no. And then they start grooming themselves, all in the first 6 seconds of an answer. And that's a cluster of indicators. This is a cluster of three indicators and not just one indicator. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Okay, welcome back. Listen, we've been discussing some of the details regarding the process that investigators use to identify lies and liars. When someone lies, the body goes through a change and the brain gets all involved in this. Lying activates three parts of the brain. It activates the temporal lobe, and that is responsible for memories and the creation of images. It also activates the frontal lobe, which is involved with suppressing the truth, and it involves the limbic system, which is activated due to the increased anxiety as a result of lying. Now, when someone lies, that person's breathing rate increases, blood pressure increases, and as a lie is told, a number of bodily reactions can occur. Among these are dilated pupils, voice pitch increase, sweating, nervousness, and then other indicators such as fidgeting, grooming themselves, eye shift, verbal physical disconnects, and many others. When someone lies, their brain experiences what is called cognitive overload and busies itself with not only keeping the facts of the lie intact, but also keeping the truth from being revealed. As a result of this cognitive overload, the brain is unable to keep tabs on all of the body's reactions. I mentioned something called verbal physical disconnects a moment ago, and this is an important indicator of this cognitive overload. Try saying yes out loud, and at the same time, shake your head no. For most people, it's very, very difficult to do. But when someone is lying because the brain is super engaged in the lying process, this can actually happen. Observing a verbal physical disconnect is one of the indicators of lying. It's important to also know the difference between global versus individual indicators. If someone is a suspect in a crime, even though they're innocent, do you think they may be nervous? You bet they will be. Now, if someone is nervous from the beginning and they remain nervous throughout the questioning process, this is what we call a global indicator, and it's not necessarily an indicator of lying. Now, on the flip side of that, if someone is calm at the beginning or during the questioning process and they become nervous only after a certain question is asked, then that is an individual indicator and an indicator of lying. When I speak to audiences across the country, we discuss a multitude of lying indicators, including verbal and physical. And what I make very clear, and I know I've said this before, is that it's not adequate to simply learn a handful of these indicators. They must know all of them. The more they know, the more accurate they will be in lie detecting. And that's the same with you. How prevalent is lying? Well, maybe prevalent is not the proper word to be using. Perhaps we should ask something more like, how rampant is lying? Let me run this by you. In an average day, if you're out and about, now if you're at home with the covers pulled up over your head all day long, of course this will not apply, but if you're out, say, in the business world among people, the hustle and bustle, you know, it's possible that you could hear as many as 100 and maybe as many as 200 lies in one day. That's amazing, isn't it? Now, when you meet someone new, you will typically hear 2 to 3 lies in the first 10 minutes of the conversation with them. Men typically will lie 5 to 6 times per day, and men will typically lie for self-aggrandizement to make themselves look good. You know, when I was a teenager, I wrestled a bear and outran a cheetah type thing. Now, women will lie 3 to 4 times a day, but their lies are typically lies of tact, self-support, oh honey, it'll be okay, that type of thing. Another interesting fact is that lying and deception accounts for approximately $1 trillion in financial loss to business every year. Now, a couple of interesting facts here, but see, it's almost time for a break. We tend to believe men with beards over anyone else. Most people find it harder to lie to people they find attractive. All right, it's time for a break. Listen, we'll be right back. I want to invite you to check out my book, Outside Your Door. Outside Your Door is a collection of true crime stories taken right from my case files and experience as a former police officer and undercover SVU detective. Some of the stories include the homicide case on which we used NASA's assistance. It includes my arrest of the Claremont Killer, as well as the undercover operation that led to my arrest of a fugitive from justice on Canada's Most Wanted. Now, Outside Your Door is not just a collection of stories about criminals. It includes stories on humanity. Ember and Quinn Hammond, co-hosts of the podcast Fiercely Altered Perspective, say of Outside Your Door, "This book really gives you the inside scoop of what happens in the life of our police, the good, the bad, and the tragic. You will laugh, and you will definitely cry." Get your copy and let me know what you think. Available online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Books A Million. Listen, there are two questions I get quite frequently when I'm talking to groups, and one of these is, when you present your How to Catch Your Liar program to people, are you not worried that you're just teaching them how to lie effectively? And my answer is, not at all. as we talked in the last section about the brain going through cognitive overload, yes, it is possible for someone who knows these indicators to mask a couple of these, such as not looking away during a lie. But because the brain is so busy trying to keep the lie straight and the truth hidden, the cognitive overload of the brain precludes them from masking all of the indicators, and that's where we get them. This is also the very reason we must know all of the indicators and not just a few. For instance, what if we only know three indicators and the person we're questioning just happens to be able to hide those very ones? But no, I'm not worried that someone can learn and mask all of them. My other question I get is, how do people usually react to you when you tell them that you know they're lying? Well, my answer to that is, I normally do not tell them. In fact, the only time I have ever told someone that they were lying to me was only a couple of times when I was interviewing or interrogating individuals when I was an SVU detective. Normally, what I do when I discover someone is lying to me, I just make a mental note of it, and if necessary, change my questioning to adjust to the lie I was just told. Now, if you're interested in learning more about detecting lies and liars, feel free to contact me through my website, and let's schedule a date and time for me to come to your company, your school, or organization and present to you the How to Catch a Liar program. All you have to do is just simply go to my website, StephenDavidLampley.com, scroll to the bottom, and find the contact link. If you have questions or want to schedule, just shoot me a message. In this program, I discuss some of the very same techniques and indicators that police detectives use to help them identify lies and liars, the same techniques and indicators I used when I was an undercover SVU detective. We will discuss such things as verbal physical disconnects in depth, base shift, illusion, elusion. We'll talk about eye shift and what I call big information. We'll discuss aggression, pronoun usage, contractions, and there's so much more. Contact us and let's schedule this two-hour program for you. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with some crime and forensic trivia and our unsolved case for the week. There have been a lot of you asking about my book, How to Catch a Liar, when it was going to be re-released. I am proud to say that autographed copies are now available. How to Catch a Liar has been updated and contains additional information. Previous edition of How to Catch a Liar is 5-star rated on Amazon. But we've done something a little different, and not only can you buy a single autographed copy, I have had it arranged where you can buy 2 and get the second autographed copy at 50% off. Get one for you and another for someone else for Christmas. Yeah, okay, I said it. Christmas. You heard it here first, right? How to Catch a Liar. Some of the same techniques and lying indicators presented at CrimeCon 2018 to a standing room only audience of 850. How to Catch a Liar autographed copies are only available at StephenDavidLampley.com/books. StephenDavidLampley.com/books. Hello, this is Stephen David Lampley, host of the new true crime radio show, Crime and Forensics, heard on my new podcast and on great radio stations across the country. Hey, if you were a listener to my weekly 10-minute true crime commentary, then you're going to love the new show. Lots more information, cold case reviews, giving you the chance to possibly help solve a homicide or a missing persons case. We'll even have an occasional guest whose name you will recognize. I'm going to give shout-outs to loyal listeners each episode and give you some crime and forensics trivia you may not know. Honestly, you never know what we're going to be doing. Tell your friends and family, share the show on your social media. Tune in to Crime and Forensics with Stephen David Lampley that's me, on my podcast and great radio stations from coast to coast. You can also hear the show on iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, Podbay FM, and TalkStream Live. As many as 1,050 were scattered across America, and they were hard to miss. Their bright orange framed lit signs, and then that chef caricature at the top. Burger Chef, hamburger, and shake restaurants were sprouting up everywhere. It was a Friday night. It was 55 degrees and rainy. It was on November 17th in 1978 in Speedway, Indiana. And Speedway is a community just west of Indianapolis. Burger Chef restaurant, located at 5724 Crawfordsville Road, had closed for the night, and the four employees began their nightly cleanup before going home. It was 12:15 a.m. when an employee who was off for that night stopped by the restaurant and wanted to talk to the employees who were supposed to be cleaning. They weren't. In fact, they were nowhere to be found. Jane Freet, age 20, Daniel Davis, age 16, Mark Flemons, age 16, and Ruth Ellen Shelton, age 18, were gone, simply disappeared. The back door of the restaurant was open, and the purses belonging to the two female employees were still in the store. A check of the cash register revealed that there was $581 missing, but there was still a large amount of cash left, as was the change. It was initially thought that the four just took the money for a night of fun. It was because of this assumption that the store was allowed to be cleaned and swept that Saturday morning. Unfortunately, this cleaning also removed any forensic evidence that could have been present. There was little concern until Jane's 1974 Chevrolet Vega was found parked in town. Suspicion began to grow that the four employees may have been abducted. If they were abducted, it was believed that the perpetrators probably entered through the back door of the restaurant, and possibly as the trash was being taken out. It was Sunday afternoon when some hikers found the four employees in the woods in Johnson County, some 20 miles from the restaurant, just off of State Route 37. But what they found was not pleasant. Daniel and Ruth had both been shot, execution style, with a .38 caliber weapon, and were lying next to each other face down in the woods. Jane had been stabbed two times in her chest, and Mark had a blunt force head injury, which is believed to have been caused, coroners say, when he fled the scene to escape, but in doing so, ran into a tree. It was later determined that Mark had been beat with a chain prior to his demise, and he died choking on his own blood. Each victim still had on the Burger Chef polyester orange and brown uniforms. There was a 16-year-old witness who stated there were two males sitting inside a vehicle outside the Burger Chef restaurant just prior to the business closing. The witness described the men as white males in their 30s, with one shaven and the other with a beard. It is believed that this began as a robbery, but that someone possibly recognized one of the perpetrators and, fearing that they would be caught, decided to kill the four employees. There have been several suspects as the investigation has progressed, but as yet no one has been charged or convicted of these heinous murders. As evidence, police have the bullets removed from Daniel and Ruth's heads, the cigarette butts from Jane's Vega. They have the knife blade that remained in Jane's chest, along with hair and blood samples and fingerprints of the victims. If you have any information about this case, I urge you to call the Speedway Police Department at 317-246-4300. Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime and Forensics with Stephen David Lampley, your crime and forensic source from coast to coast.
To find out more about our show, guests or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.